Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at offbeatoregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Today we have for you a brand new episode just come out from under the 60-day embargo period during which our participating newspapers have exclusive rights. Thanks for downloading, and I hope you enjoy the show. This story was first published on November 24th of 2024 under the headline Drunk Tweet Led to Fight with Dr. John McLaughlin. Here we go. Earlier this year, as you may remember, country music singer Zach Bryan had a few too many alcoholic beverages before pulling out his phone and opening X, the app formerly known as Twitter. "Eagles greater than Chiefs," he tweeted tipsily. "Kanye greater than Taylor. Who's with me?" By the way, greater than, I mean the greater than a mathematical symbol was what he tweeted. It's not clear exactly what Bryan intended. Most likely he was sort of joke trolling the Taylor Swift fan community, which as he realized the next morning when he awakened with a penitent headache and looked at his phone, is about as good an idea as sneaking up behind a sleeping grizzly bear for the old popping a paper bag prank. A few days of red-faced apologies later, Bryan deleted his Twitter account, explaining that he'd decided it was too tempting for him, especially after a few beers. "It gets me in trouble too much," he wrote on an Instagram post. "Don't drink and tweet! Don't drink and tweet!" And this seems to have done the trick. The kerfluffle faded quickly away. Probably that's because Bryan's last line rang like a bell. Nearly everyone who has a social media account and is not an absolute teetotaler has had the experience of waking up the next morning after a friend's birthday party and discovering that he has embarrassed himself with a late-night Facebook post that seemed like the right thing to do at the time. But, well, the first drunk tweet in Oregon history didn't end nearly so benignly. Maybe it would have if Twitter had been a thing in March of 1838 when, fortified with a nice zesty jolt of old French brandy, the Reverend Herbert Beaver took quill pen in hand and sat down to compose it, but then again maybe not. Now, I have to confess that I have no hard evidence that Beaver was drunk when he belted out his handwritten tweet. But one of the unintended consequences of the tweet much later would be the publishing of Beaver's household liquor consumption, which was absolutely heroic, in the old-school medical sense of the term heroic. I figure a fellow who burns through the alcoholic equivalent of 17/5 of Jack Daniels every month probably can be assumed to be no stranger to the whole Dutch courage thing when sitting down to write an angry letter. The thing about that letter, and the reason it had something in common with a modern social media post, was that it was basically a public statement. There was no assurance of privacy in it. As a matter of general administration, Fort Vancouver's chief factor, Dr. John McLaughlin, looked over all the outgoing correspondence before sending it off to London. Now, Beaver may have assumed that this would not be the case with his correspondence. He was the official chaplain for Fort Vancouver, having been appointed to his post by the Hudson's Bay Company's governor in London, so he figured, perhaps, that he was only answerable to the governor and not to McLaughlin at all. McLaughlin, though, disagreed and considered Beaver to be his subordinate. The two of them had already clashed more than once as a result of this misunderstanding, which was made worse by the fact that McLaughlin's wife, Marguerite Mackay, was a devout Catholic, and he himself had Catholic sympathies. Like a lot of Protestants back then, Beaver detested quote-unquote papists, as he called them, on general principles. Not surprisingly, this had become a sore point between them, made worse because McLaughlin's marriage to Marguerite was of the informal fur trade style kind, which is basically a common law marriage. Beaver considered fur trade marriages to be living in sin, and was forever pushing the traders to sanctify their unions with the Indian and half-Indian ladies who graced their households with a formal marriage ceremony. McLaughlin stubbornly refused to let Beaver formalize his marriage to Marguerite. This may have been because the devoutly Catholic Marguerite wouldn't allow an Anglican wedding, or he may just have been being stubborn. In any case, it was clearly very much on Beaver's mind that evening as he stretched out his pen. The tweet was in reference to Marguerite MacKay. He referred to her, this is the tweet now, as a female of notoriously loose character and as the kept mistress of the highest personage in your service. Naturally, when the autocratic and hot-tempered McLaughlin read those lines while reviewing the outgoing correspondence, he was incandescent with rage. Immediately, he fired off a peremptory order commanding Beaver to come to his office immediately. Beaver, doubtless a little daunted, but still refusing to recognize McLaughlin's right to issue such an order, ignored him. This can't have improved McLaughlin's mood much, nor did it buy him much time. The next day, the two men encountered each other by chance in the courtyard at the fort. Beaver had prepared for such a chance by bringing a heavy walking stick, but this ended up making things worse for him, as an infuriated McLaughlin, roaring, "You scoundrel! I will have your life!" pounced upon him. Even with a stick, Beaver was no match for McLaughlin, who was 6'4" tall and built like a draft horse. After taking several kicks and punches, Beaver dropped his stick, which his wife picked up. McLaughlin then wrenched the stick away from her and gave her husband a couple lusty whacks across the shoulders with it, before several bystanders arrived to help Mary Beaver stop the fight. The following day, realizing he'd gone too far, McLaughlin apologized to Beaver for the attack. This Beaver spurned, and it is clear that he felt McLaughlin's violence had delivered him, and perhaps the company, into his hands, writes historian W.K. Lamb. Ill-concealed exultation, as well as righteous indignation, blazes up in the account of the affair that he sent to London. Perhaps luckily for all involved, McLaughlin left 2 days later for a previously scheduled overland journey into Canada, and in his absence, James Douglas was left in charge. Well, Douglas was at pains to keep Beaver as happy as he could, and for some time he thought it was working great. It should have been a great relationship, really, as Douglas and his now wife, Amelia Connolly, had been the first marriage ceremony that Beaver had presided over at the fort. Douglas and Connolly had, of course, been fur trade-style spouses before that. But it was not to be. The break literally happened in the middle of a letter Douglas was writing to London, in which he copiously praises Beaver's efforts in one paragraph, and a few lines later, which were written a few hours later, speaks very disparagingly and contemptuously of him. So, what happened in those few hours? Well, once again, Beaver sent a tweet in his report to London, which obviously at this point he knew very well that the head of the fort would be reading, and it included this line. I see the principal house in your establishment made a common receptacle for every mistress of an officer in the service who may take a fancy to visit the fort. I know my Reverend Herbert Beaver voice sounds a little bit like an old drunk guy, but... well, 17 bottles of Jack Daniels a month? Really? Anyway, Douglas was incensed. He dashed off a note to Beaver demanding that he explain what this meant and who these mistresses he's referring to were, and Beaver replied to this note in very formal terms, declining to provide any explanation, and after that the two of them were no longer on speaking terms. So Douglas dashed off a lengthy letter to London, rebutting Beaver's accusations and disclosing his consumption rate of brandy, port, and other liquors, as mentioned above. And yes, I did the math. And literally, it comes to the equivalent in alcohol of 17 750-liter bottles of Jack Daniel's 40% whiskey. That's how much alcohol Beaver was drinking every month. Well, and maybe his wife helped him out, but... gosh. Anyway, I guess we all have our own special superpowers, and it would appear that all aspiring heavy drinkers can only look at the Reverend Herbert Beaver with awe and admiration. Anyway, back to our story. At the very next opportunity, Beaver embarked for London, quote,
for the purpose of instituting legal proceedings against Chief Factor McLaughlin,
as he put it. And this he attempted to do after arriving home in May 1839, but nothing came of it, and shortly thereafter he was told that his services would no longer be needed, and was hit in the backside with a check for £110 sterling to settle any claims against McLaughlin and the company that he might still have. Beaver went on to become a chaplain in the British Army in South Africa, where in 1858, at the age of 58, he died. I don't have a cause of death, but that rate of alcohol consumption will kill you that soon, so yeah. McLaughlin wouldn't get off unscathed either. The Hudson's Bay Company brass in London never quite trusted him after this incident, especially as he started befriending American settlers who arrived in the country destitute. Eventually, they tried to kick him upstairs by offering him a promotion that would require him to move back east, and he resigned and took up a land claim at Willamette Falls in what is now Oregon City. By the time he died, he was a naturalized American citizen. It is tempting to think of Herbert Beaver as a sanctimonious clown, a hard-drinking version of Jane Austen's Mr. Collins from Pride and Prejudice. And there is, as we've seen, something to that view. His anti-Catholic sentiments were over the top even for the 1830s, and his constant complaints about the inadequacy of his housing and the unsuitability of the servants assigned to him in this roughest of frontier outposts didn't, and still don't, endear him much to readers of his whiny, petulant letters. But there are a couple of things that should be mentioned about him, and maybe they actually make up for all the unnecessary trouble and drama that he caused. First and foremost, there's the issue of slavery. The Indians of the Pacific Northwest did practice slavery, pressing war captives into forced service, and under McLaughlin, the Hudson's Bay Company followed this custom. That, of course, was a blatant violation of English law and company policy, and Beaver, when he learned this, had a fit, and it's chiefly thanks to him that this practice was put a stop to. He also had a point about those fur trade marriages. See, the problem with them was the women might have been committed to them, but often the men were not. And when they weren't, there really wasn't any legal protection for the cast-aside women, including Marguerite McKay herself, Mrs. McLaughlin, basically, who was a former cast-aside fur trade wife. She'd been fur trade married to trader Alexander McKay, who had deserted her, and that happened a lot in the company's remotest outposts. And it resulted in a lot of abandoned wives and semi-orphaned children dependent upon the charity of the company. It was blatantly unfair, it was clearly immoral by the lights of the church, and Beaver did his best to stand up to it. So yeah, in spite of all the trouble Beaver encountered, including the healthy portion that he laid upon himself, he did some real good at the fort, giving at least a dozen fur trade wives some stability and legal status and ending slavery in the Oregon Territory for good. It makes one wonder how much different history could have been if only Beaver had had a little less of a tendency to drunk tweet and a little more generosity of spirit. Key sources in this story have included works by Thomas E. Jessett, W. K. Lamb, Herbert Beaver, and R. C. Clarke. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. I do hope you enjoyed it. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Check out our hub page at offbeatoregon.com to explore all the other things we do or to find the full citations and visuals that go with today's show. And if you haven't already, check out our Offbeat Oregon books, basically revised, updated, re-researched collections of these columns and podcasts arranged by topic. So we've got Heroes and Rascals of Old Oregon, Love, Sex, and Murder in Old Oregon, and Bad Ideas and Horrible People of Old Oregon out and about. And I'm working on a fourth title now. Also, just wanted to give a quick shout out about my other podcast, which is a weekly podcast called the Penny Dreadful Reading Hour. So if you like listening to me talk and you like Sweeney Todd, the Demon Barber of Fleet Street, and Varney the Vampire, and other similar, you know, scurrilous literature, you might enjoy it. Check it out. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts with a search for Penny Dreadful Story Hour. This podcast is covered under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike license, version 4.0 International. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band out of Seattle, up in the Washington Territory, and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Episodes of Offbeat Oregon come out once per weekday, usually around 6 a.m., and so it won't be long before the next episode is on your device and ready for you to queue up. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day and the weekend with good stuff. Bye now.